So one of the ways we can understand the practice that we're doing on retreat or outside of retreat is that it involves a process of simplification, a process of becoming in some ways simpler. It isn't necessarily that our activities become simpler or all the various relationships and work that we have in the world become simpler, but that there's simplification of who we are in relationship to all that. A simplification of how we are in relationship to all that. And on retreat like this, the form of the retreat, of Vipassana retreats, is a very simple form. And there's various reasons for the simplicity of the form. And sometimes people think that Vipassana has no form. But I think it's a fairly conscious form where there is a form, and the form is simplicity. It's bordering on having no form at all. That simplicity is in some ways mimics or in some ways mirrors, maybe is a better word, the simplicity of being which the practice is pointing towards. So in retreat, there's very little activities that we do. There's very little talking that goes on, and very little kind of normal relatedness that goes on between people. And our life is reduced to kind of as simple as it can possibly get. I suppose we could have it a little bit simpler if we have no yogi jobs, but that's not our way. And so that outer simplicity becomes then a mirror for the possibility of discovering some inner simplicity. And perhaps as we leave the retreat then is to carry with us that inner simplicity, simplicity of being, simplicity of into the rest of our life. Simplicity is doing simple things can in the surface seem very boring. And people have various negative attitude towards it. But it can also open up to some real profundity within us. If you take a passage, say a passage from scriptures, from Buddhist scripture or Christian scripture or almost any kind of passage, paragraph, whatever, from some serious work, and you reread it 100 times, that the words are the same. The first time you read it, you understand what's there, and you have some logical, rational understanding what's there perhaps, or it speaks to you in some intuitive way or emotional way or whatever. But as you keep rereading it, the words don't change. The page doesn't change. But what changes with each reading is yourself. And sometimes with the kind of continuous reading of the same passage over and over, a depth of associations, a depth of feelings, of relationships, kind of an inner world begins to change within us as we grapple and reflect and are molded and shaped by what we're reading. There's a richness in the inner world that gets developed. As we live this very simple life on retreat and just do something as simple as be with the breath, but not just with the breath 100 times, but 100,000 times, that the simplicity of that allows for something else to happen within us that is not obvious when you just look at the surface. It's very common for people who are new to retreats, new to practice, to think of the breath as being phenomenally boring. How could anybody spend, you know, more than 3 breaths looking at their breath, because it's the most boring thing in the world? But that staying with the simple thing of the breath, and it's like staying with a passage of scripture or whatever, allows for something to happen within us, some shifting within us, that opens up or expresses or manifests a depth of richness of who we are as human being, a depth of beingness that is often masked and hidden by the complicated way in which we tend to live our lives. In kind of our modern society, in some Dharma talks or something, there's sometimes a dichotomy offered between being and doing. And doing in this dichotomy is often considered to be the bad guy, and being is a better state to be in. Pure Buddhist way of talking, the dichotomy should be between becoming and being. And the doing itself is not problematized in Buddhism. It's fine to do things. But it's becoming which is a problem. And becoming here means the act of trying to make yourself into something else, to change who you are. Not simply to go to school and get a degree because it's useful to have a good job, but to tie up your identity, your sense of self-worth, your sense of definition, this is who I actually am. The way we harden ourselves around some defining characteristic of this is who I am, that process of becoming something in that way is considered to be problematic, simply because it causes a lot of suffering to harden ourselves around a certain identity. And the sense of being, as opposed to becoming, doesn't require us to be anything, doesn't require us to become something, doesn't require us to avoid being anything. It's just kind of a much more simple state of just letting life move through us as it is, letting ourselves be present for life in a sense the most simple way we can. So we find in Buddhism sometimes we talk about acceptance, that the practice of Buddhism is an acceptance practice, learning to accept things as they are. And some of you talked about that today for interviews. Your intention was to learn to be accepting of things. And sometimes that's misunderstood as being meaning accepting everything the way it is, condoning and becoming passive towards the way things are in the world. Accepting doesn't necessarily mean we accept the things of the world as they are. It means that it means that the awareness, the attention, our heart, does not contract around the way things are. That our awareness stays open and fluid and relaxed around the way things are. What our discriminating thinking might do, it might decide, well, if one of you steps out here on the deck and you find there's a nail sticking up out of the deck, I hope you just don't accept that and move on. Your awareness should accept that. There's no reason for you to get upset or angry and, how could someone have left a nail there? And how could, Gil's a teacher and he should know better than having, and suddenly the mind gets all contracted and upset. And then you might relate it to yourself and say, well, there's a nail sticking out. There's something fundamentally flawed here at Jokoji. And how could I have chosen such a retreat center to go on? I'm really a mess, the fact that I keep choosing these kinds of retreat centers. I've heard of retreat centers that are, a little bit more plush. And why didn't I have a good enough sense to choose one of those? And so suddenly, the contraction is not about the place, but it turned back towards oneself. Different people have different preferences of where the contraction goes, the direction it goes. Acceptance means that we don't do that kind of contraction. And then we can use, kind of in a relaxed way, our discriminating thinking and say, well, in fact, there's a nail here, someone else might get hurt, I better do something about that, either tell a caretaker or get a hammer or myself and knock it out of the way. But acceptance is a very important part of what we're learning in mindfulness practice. And accepting ourselves as we are, whatever we are. And one of the ways of not accepting who we are is to live under the shoulds and shouldn'ts. I shouldn't be this way, or I should be this way. I should be a different way. And so then there's the process of becoming comes into play. I'll try to become something different than what I am right now. And it's, of course, very seductive to do this because as you sit here and are mindful of yourself, sometimes it's not a very pretty picture, what you see. And you become aware of, for example, your anger or your fear or your self-centeredness or something that maybe causes suffering, your judgmentalism or something. And you're really, really painful to be always judging other people, always painful to be a certain way. And you think, it would be a lot better not to be that way. And it would be a lot better for the people around you if you weren't that way. So I think what I'll do is, I should become different. There's the becoming comes into play. I should be different. I should become different. I should get rid of that part of myself. And the challenge, I think, of Buddhist teaching is it points to the fact that it points to there's a problem with the act of becoming, of trying to become something. Even if it's trying to become something wholesome and good. Something that seems meritorious and worthwhile to do. And then you might think, well, Buddhism seems to be a kind of hopeless religion, doesn't offer me any hope of change. But the hope that Buddhism offers is a hope that's the most radical part of Buddhism is to step outside of the system of good and bad, of shoulds and shouldn'ts. Step outside of the whole game of self-improvement. And to kind of maybe pull the rug from under that in a sense, in order to learn how to rest very deeply in just being who we are. Most of the movements, most of the unwholesome movements that cause us suffering within us, arise out of a foundation of non-acceptance. And so if we practice acceptance, sooner or later you're going to pull the rug from underneath all the movements of non-acceptance. So the process, it's a process of simplification. And there's a number of ways in which the process of enlightenment, the stages of enlightenment are described. But generally they're described also as a process of simplification. Simplifying ourselves of things which are extra. And the first thing that's said to be simplified, that we recognize as being extra, is the belief in identity, identification. The process of identification. The Pali word is sakkaya ditti. Sa means with. It could either mean with, it also means, some people mean sat, which means true. And kaya means body. So it either means either with the body, or some people prefer to translate it as true body, the belief in a true body, sakkaya ditti. Translated into English as the belief in identity. Belief that something out there in here will identify or define who you are, as if you can be defined. And I think many of us have seen the suffering that is entailed around being defined in certain ways. It's easy to see when other people define us. You know, please don't define myself. Don't limit me that way. Don't. Once upon a time, we just maybe kind of bordered on being angry with someone. And so now they carry around this idea that you're always an angry person. And you feel limited by that definition that person has for you. Some people, for example, are defined by their spouses. And it feels very limiting or very disrespectful to be always defined in relationship to someone's spouse. Some people we can see define themselves in certain ways. And it's very easy sometimes to spot it in other people, that they always see themselves in certain ways. They always define themselves as being someone who's incapable, or they define themselves always someone who's capable, or they define themselves always someone who, you know, needs to protect themselves, or they define themselves always in some way. And it's sometimes easy to spot that in other people, and you kind of see the suffering there. You wish they would kind of relax a little bit and not limit themselves that way. What's much harder to do is to see it for ourselves, how we define ourselves, and then limit ourselves by that definition. And the whole belief and definition for ourselves and identity for ourselves is the first process of simplification, which is let go of, and this process of liberation. As a, you know, I haven't studied these very much, but you know, as a child grows up, one of the important things that happens as a child grows up is they begin to understand themselves in relationship to other people, and a relational sense of self develops. And I suppose it's quite normal and healthy to do that. But what happens is that the relation of self, so sense of self, which is certainly a real enough thing, we understand ourselves in relationship to other people. Other people have, everyone else has small noses and you have a big nose, and so you understand that. I mean, that's, you know, so you define yourself, you understand something about how you are. In Japan, it was very useful for people in Japan to understand that I was taller than everyone else in the monastery. So when there were things on the high shelf to get, they would call on me to get it. That's a very kind of simplistic, maybe silly example, but there's a understanding how we're different and similar to other people is a normal thing, because we are normal. We are in many ways different and similar to other people. But what happens is with time is that we kind of fixate and harden ourselves in defining this is who I am in relationship to other people. And so we develop a relational sense of self, that who I am is defined by how I am in relationship and comparisons to other people. Or other people's expectations or ideals, or in relationship to who I was in the past. So the comparison is to myself in the past, or myself and who I hope to be in the future. And And as I said, I think the relational sense of self can be a realistic thing that we understand, but it can also be a source of tremendous suffering. And one of the ways in which it causes suffering is we think that in order to be happy in some deep way, we have to adjust the relational self. We have to shift it around and become a better self so that people will like us. My first interests in seriously doing Buddhist meditation practice was I wanted to have more friends. And I thought that was a way to get more friends, was somehow, magically, I don't know how, that I'd be a better person and people would like me more. So to expect that to put all our eggs in the basket of needing to be a certain thing for the world around us, to be a hermit and be retreat from the world and protect ourselves, and or to put up walls of defense or carry ourselves around the world in a particular way so that we make ourselves safe or make ourselves seen in some way, or to feel only feel inspired and uplifted in life if you're reassured that people see you in a certain way. The whole thing of relational, how people see us and how we want people to see us and how we expect them to see us and how we're afraid they might be seeing us is a source of a lot of suffering for a lot of people. You see it for people who are new on retreat, who've never been on retreat before. And one of the guidelines that's often spoken about at the beginning of retreat is not to make any eye contact. And so people are going to go around with their eyes cast down. And for someone who doesn't know the scene, they relate it to normal society. In normal society, when everyone is avoiding you by keeping their eyes down, it means something, you know, is fishy. You know, they're embarrassed about you, or upset, or angry, or something, and it's kind of a little bit awkward if people don't kind of treat you that, you know, some direct contact. So people come on retreat and they associate that their well-being. They want to find reassurance by knowing how they stand in relationship to other people, and if other people are not talking to them or looking at them a certain way or smiling a certain way, they feel quite at sea. Some people feel quite terrified in the beginning of being in retreat because all the ways in which they have of finding a relational self, who they are in relation to other people, all the usual ways are missing. So then it's possible to kind of then try to, you know, the thing about establishing a relational sense of self and trying to find a good one or a safe one or whatever is that it's an endless task. And you might find that the current situation is not acceptable, so I'm going to find another relational sense of self that works better, or reestablish the relationships. But the relational sense of self is always going to be unstable, because the relationships are always unstable. Relationships are always changing. People move, all kinds of ways in which people move away, people die, their relationships change or whatever. And so the relational sense, if your sense of self, your hardening sense of self is dependent on the people around you, then as the people around you shift and change, then it becomes awkward to maintain the old sense. And in fact, the relational sense of self, if that's the only place your security and well-being is to be found, you know, you'll exhaust yourself constantly trying to adjust it and find a new way of being in relationship to other people. And I liken it to, you know, rearranging the furniture in the Titanic. The Titanic is going to go down. And it's nice to kind of line up all the chairs on the deck of the Titanic so they look pretty, but the Titanic's going down. You better get it in a lifeboat. And what Dharma practice is offering is a lifeboat. It's offering a way of getting off the boat that's sinking, off kind of this closed loop, this closed system, which as long as you stay inside this closed system, it's always going to be fragile and unstable. And so instead of becoming and always becoming something, the relational self is always something that's becoming, in the process of becoming and being created, is to learn something about being and resting in our beingness. And the kind of radical challenge for many of us is that to really take this to heart and seriously, it means to step out of any attempt to try to improve ourselves, any attempt to try to make things better for ourselves, anything to fix ourselves, but rather to practice some very radical acceptance, where even those parts of ourselves we don't like, even those parts of us which find suffering, we open to and find some accepting presence, to accepting awareness to hold that and be there for it. And then you might think, well, why should I bother with that? I mean, why should I open to my suffering? Why should I open to those parts of myself which are unacceptable? Because it allows for a depth of freedom, a depth of well-being to surface and show. And allows for a depth of compassion to shine forth. As long as we're trying to adjust the relational sense of self, there's very little space for compassion. So the part of the process of simplification is this process of learning not to identify with things. And another way of perhaps saying that is learning not to take things personally. And in terms of normal conversations with people, I mean, sometimes you get that advice. So you say, someone said something to me or something happened at work, and someone will say, don't take it so personally. It's not about you. The person was having a hard day and just needed to vent to someone, and you happen to be the convenient person there. And then you say, oh, you don't take it so personally then. Ajahn Sumedho recently was talking about a crisis they had in their monastery in England. I don't know if this explains, this is an example very well. But there was a local English woman who really didn't like their presence, these Buddhist monastics with shaved heads walking down the narrow country lanes in England, you know, these proper English people. It's kind of a conservative, religious part of England, having these Buddhist monks. It wasn't a good thing. And so she was kind of campaigning to get rid of them. And she was a primary kind of enemy of sorts. And one day she was found snooping around the monastery. And so the monk found her kind of snooping around. He said, what are you doing here? And there was a little heated discussion back and forth. This American monk who had found her got a little bit angry and called her a woman. Woman, she said something like, woman, you shouldn't be here. Like this way, woman, if you're welcome to come here and you're on friendly terms, but you know, woman, whatever. And now, apparently, to a proper English woman, to be called a woman is a height of insults. It's very insulting. I didn't know that, but apparently, she was tremendously insulted by this. You called me woman, and this precipitated a big scandal, and a lot of her, you know, angry feelings. So that Ajahn Sumedho felt the need to go to visit her in her house, have tea at her house, and somehow apologize for this American monk. And he brought with him an Irish monk. Apparently, was aristocrat. I don't know if there are aristocrats in Ireland. No, I don't know. Maybe I misheard the story. But they brought along this man, another monk, and they were having tea. And she was angry. And finally, this Irish man or whatever leaned across the table and said, "But ma'am, you have to realize, he was an American." And then immediately said, okay. Then, you know, there's no need to take it personally then. He was an American. He didn't know how it is here in England. And so suddenly, and everything was cleared, cleaned. That little understanding kind of lifted, you know. Americans are forgiven anything in England. They're not part of the system. The inbred kind of class system of English society. So it's common for people to say, you know, don't take it personally. But Buddhist practice says don't take it personally for all the stuff inside. Don't take your thoughts personally. Don't take your feelings personally. Don't take your sensations personally. And that's another way of saying don't identify with them. Don't harden around them, saying this is defining who I am. And imagine what freedom it is not to have anything define who you are. You know, you don't die, you're not defined by anything. But rather, you become free. Or rather, life lives through you, in a sense. There's a lot of wonderful things in life which function quite well without those things knowing themselves. Like the eyes. The eyes don't see each other. The eyes don't see themselves. But the eyes function usually quite well. The people who use this kind of language will talk about a knife can't cut itself, or lips can't kiss themselves. Beingness, there's something about beingness which has that quality. It's almost like you can't know itself. Or the presence or knowing, the awareness itself, that some of you have pointed out, it's been kind of tricky to kind of investigate the sense of awareness. What is awareness? Awareness is maybe one of the most important qualities you have as a human being. But how do you let awareness know awareness? Is it kind of like the eye seeing itself? So when I was at this retreat last week with Ajahn Sumedho, he talked a lot about trusting awareness, and that spoke very well to me. What we do in practice is trust our awareness. We trust the knowing. We trust the mindfulness. There needs to be some process of faith or trust in any process of deep spiritual simplification. Trust or faith is a very important quality in practice. We say at the beginning of retreat, it's very important to establish your practice in refuge, in the triple refuge, in refuge in Buddha, Dharma, Sangha, which we chanted yesterday. And the question is, what is refuge? What is it to take refuge? And there's many ways in which people have talked about what refuge means, what Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha mean. But I suspect, I feel, you know, for me at least, for the refuge really to have meaning, to be something that actually can be used in the present moment, not in this abstract idea that just simply inspires me or reminds me of a possibility or offers me hope. Refuge has to be something quite immediate and quite tangible, something available right now. So what is it? How do we understand Buddha, Dharma, Sangha? That something about it is available right now to us. It's in our own experience, not something outside of it. So we can't find refuge in it and come to it. And I think that, you know, the Buddha then is not the Buddha of 2,500 years ago, but the Buddha is that possibility of being awake, wakefulness. And I'm kind of fond of the fact that Buddhism defines the goal of Buddhism, the Buddha defined the goal of Buddhism, to be awake. Because to be awake is a different word than the word attain. So it isn't that the Buddha said the purpose of Buddhism is to attain something. Because to attain something is to be caught up in the world of becoming again, of creating something, of becoming something different than what you are. But to be awake, you can wake up to anything. You can wake up to things as the way they are. There's something about the nature of being awake, which is a refuge, which is a source of confidence and trust, something we can trust. There's something about the nature of awake, being awake, that allows us to step outside of the inbred kind of self-contained system of things like the relational self that we often negotiating and working within. And so the point of practice is to learn to be awake with our experience, not to change our experience. So what does it mean to be awake? And awakefulness has a lot to do with awareness, to be aware. To be aware in an alert way, clear way, peaceful way, in a non-reactive way. Awake, in my mind, kind of has a sense of a presence or an awareness which encompasses, is larger than, but encompasses what you're aware of. When I'm awake, there's a kind of clarity and openness to what's there, so that there's a broad acceptance of what's there. And the marvelous thing is that you can notice the process of identification. You can notice how you fall into the personality, identity belief. I want to be this way. I want that person to see me that way. I want to say something in such a way that that person will have a favorable impression of me. And one approach to practice is to see that clearly and bring more mindfulness to bear on it and try to understand what the attachment is and try to relax that attachment and let go of it. And that's a very valuable way of practicing. Another way, they're not exclusive of each other, the other way is to be awake to that. And being awake to that, seeing very clearly that process of identification, and not feeling, not needing to get rid of it, not needing to stop it or change it or anything, but in that process of seeing it clearly, being awake to it, not be caught by it. So somehow the nature of awareness steps us outside the system. Awareness itself doesn't identify. So one of the ways which we identify and get caught by something, like I say we identify with being a certain way, I need to be a good meditator. All the other people around me are sitting really still, and I need to sit really still also so that they think well of me. If I shift my posture one more time, they're probably going to think I'm, you know, a terrible meditator, and that's not any good. And so you have that kind of thought arises in your mind. And so you see, so to wake up to that is to see it, oh, I am trying to be something, I'm trying to become something, I'm trying to hold myself or define myself in a certain way. There's a should and shouldn't I'm living by. And in seeing that very clearly, you're not caught by it. So you don't have to get rid of it. It's just this kind of a freedom that occurs while that's happening. Kind of the wakefulness is larger than that. And then perhaps it just dissipates by itself. It relaxes by itself. So to trust awareness, to trust wakefulness, is to find some capacity of being aware that's larger or more accepting of what's actually happening in the present moment. And for that to happen, you don't have to change anything. You don't have to be a different kind of person. You don't have to stop having that headache. You don't have to stop having your knees hurting. You don't have to stop being sad. You don't have to stop being afraid. You don't have to stop being happy. And in fact, I think that wakefulness brings happiness. I think it's kind of like happiness bubbles up into it. So, so take refuge in the Buddha, I think, is to take refuge in awareness. And it can be a little bit tantalizing, a little bit, you feel very vulnerable to do that. Because awareness doesn't have any much to offer in the sense of a definition of who we are, or it doesn't increase your bank account, it doesn't, a lot of things, you know, just awareness is kind of, as you said, you can't even find, it's very difficult even to pinpoint it. Where is it? And so if you're looking for security in something, you'd like to have security in something that's tangible, in something that's, you know, very solid. And here you're asked in Buddhism to take refuge and find security in something which is quite intangible in a sense, and kind of almost recedes from your presence as you bring attention to it. And so I think part of the process is a willingness to be vulnerable. The willingness kind of to be on the edge of not knowing who you are, not knowing what's supposed to happen, not knowing. So important process of the retreat is this process of simplification, becoming simpler. And in the first days of the retreat, one of the ways we do that is to keep the practice particularly simple by just staying with the breath, staying with the breathing. And the concentration practice of concentrating on the breath can be understood as a simplification practice. And one of the ways that simplifying things is by having all of who we are integrated, unified, focused on the breath. Many of us come to retreat or we'll go about our life fragmented, with many minds going many different directions and many different concerns. Something happened in the days before the retreat and our mind keeps going back to that. Something's going to happen in the future and our mind keeps going to that. We're involved in some wonderful project and our mind keeps drifting off to the project. The mind very easily kind of scatters out in many different concerns and preoccupations. The process of developing concentration and simplification is to bring all the different forces within us together, united, to bear on the simple act of the breath. Or to say it another way, perhaps, I don't know if this is very, very articulate or makes sense, but I'll do my best, is we have this vitality within us. Life force, vitality. Jiva, sometimes it's called in Pali. This vitality within us. And that vitality, that aliveness, that live energy, can go in many different directions. And sometimes it goes into directions which are dead ends. And it goes into unconscious directions. And it goes off and can split in many different directions. And the process of developing concentration is a process of harnessing our energy, harnessing our vitality. So our vitality, we bring along, we harness our vitality, so it all goes in the direction of developing concentration in the breath, or being with the breath. What it means is that it doesn't mean you have to stop the mind wandering off and thinking about other things, but rather there's no energy given to that. The vitality doesn't go into thinking about past and future, or goes into kind of problem solving, whatever we might do, but rather a real kind of living, vital, hopefully pleasant kind of sense of vitality is channeled. Okay, this is where I'm going to put it. I'm going to put it in through my breath, the awareness of the breath, be present for the breath. And so the analogy I used this morning, which I like a lot, is the idea of that the concentration in the breath is like making an umbrella. And as you focus on the breath, your vitality, your life energy, in a sense, your intention, is living intention is challenged and is channeled into the breath and kept there, sustained there, with a kind of resolve and kind of dedication. So if anything else arises in the mind or feelings, that it's fine for it to arise. You don't have to stop it or interrupt it or fight it. But you just let it kind of wash off the top of the umbrella. Just kind of let it fall away. You just kind of stay focused. Or maybe another analogy which I like is kind of like the prow of the boat, the front of a boat. And it's cutting through the water. We keep our focus on cutting through the water, meeting the breath. And there's a lot of things that happen on the sides in the wake of the boat, wash along the side of the boat. But we don't stop for those things. But we just stay with the breath. We stay with those breaths. They're resolved. And that process of staying with the breath and being simple and not moving from the breath and allowing other things to kind of fall away allows for a process of simplification. Because as we don't take this vital force, this vital energy or living intention, and it's kind of like our living intention or living attention is kind of like a food which feeds things. And if that food of attention goes into our neurosis, then we feed our neurosis. It gets stronger. If we're sitting here thinking about some problem at work or some sense of identity we're trying to protect or enhance at work or whatever, then in some way that attention that goes into that is feeding it. But if you don't feed something, then it can't be sustained. It doesn't sustain itself, and it fades away. And so we take the food of attention and we feed it to something wholesome. We feed it to the breath. And we keep feeding it to the breath and feeding it to the breath and have a pretty simple resolve. And allowing, accepting everything else. There's not a feeling of not accepting the other things. There's not a feeling of rejecting other things or being critical of whatever might arise, however difficult it might be and however agitated the mind might be. All those things are quite generously allowed to be as they are. But very simply, very matter-of-factly, very lovingly, gently, hopefully, this food that we have within us, the attention, is fed to the breath, or is fed to awareness of the breath. So we're cultivating and developing the awareness of the breathing. And then as we do that, it's kind of like reading those scriptural passages 100 times, that it allows for something else to begin churning and developing within us. And then we let whatever might happen churn within us, we let that come up. And some of what comes up will make it difficult to stay with the breath. And some of what comes up can be channeled back into the breath and make it easier to be with the breath. As the sense of being focused on the breath develops, there can often be a sense of well-being. So the first thing can be a very kind of subtle hint of sense of well-being, sense of pleasure, a sense of wholeness, a sense of calm that might develop. And it's very useful to notice that now there's different parts of you, parts of your body, part of your emotional body, part of your mind as the mind gets stiller and inspired, that is somehow also now wrapping itself around the breath or being directed towards the breath participating in this process of staying focused on the breath. It becomes kind of like a biofeedback kind of a thing. You notice certain qualities are changed. As you get concentrated, you notice certain things inside of you are shifting. And they'll use those things to support the development of concentration. Now, of course, you have to be very careful when you do this, because you can very easily fall into the trap of trying to become something. Now you're trying to become concentrated and trying to create concentration, trying to attain concentration. In a sense, we are trying to develop more concentration in the beginning of the retreat, but not at the expense of this of acceptance practice, not at the expense of actually letting there be kind of a sense of being, appreciation of just beingness. And rather to let the concentration, perhaps, if this makes sense to you, arise through beingness, through just being. Being is to be simple. Concentration is the process of getting concentrated is a process of simplification. Becoming simpler and simpler. And as I said yesterday, I think, or this morning, it's not as important to get concentrated as it is to lovingly try to become concentrated. There is a tremendous amount of spiritual benefit to simply trying to become concentrated. And if you feel like you're the greatest disaster that ever struck people concentrating, don't worry about that. I've actually seen sometimes much greater benefit, personal benefit, for people who struggled with concentration but couldn't get concentrated than people who had great ease in getting concentrated. There's a tremendous amount of self-confrontation, meeting oneself, and depth of all kinds of things that get churned up and released in the process of simply trying to get concentrated. So I hope I haven't confused you here by offering, by talking kind of out both sides of my mouth, by saying on one hand, you know, just we're practicing acceptance and being simple and just being as opposed to becoming. And then the other side of my mouth saying, well, actually developing concentration is very important also. Which sounds like a becoming and being. And if I was better able to explain myself, I'd be able to explain how you can these two things actually don't have to be seen as separate, but can exist, coexist together as one process. So the process of simplification involves a process of moving to increasing levels of peace, becoming more and more peaceful. So as you sit here, I encourage you to be very attentive, and whenever you notice there's a choice between being more peaceful or being more agitated, more peaceful or more contracted, choose being more peaceful with how things are. Be more peaceful, more still. And the greater the stillness in which you can go about your days here on the retreat, the simpler you can live your life here. The less activity you do that's at all extra, beyond the kind of the scope of the basic, very simple activity here, the greater that'll help the process of simplification of the mind and the purification process that occurs as we do that. Don't underestimate the tremendous benefit of the purification process that the practice entails. Don't measure yourself against how you think things should be or how you want them to be, but rather meet each moment as it's given to you. Meet each moment as it is, with awareness, with acceptance, with trust. Trusting that whatever occurs here, if you can just be there for present for it, it's not a problem. It's just what is. So one of the things that you might investigate in the next day is this first issue of identification belief. You might be a little bit extra sensitive to the ways in which you define yourselves and maybe suffer because of it, all the ways in which you try to become something and be something. And maybe as you investigate that, the process of identification, the process of taking things personally, exploring what it's like not to do that, if that's possible, that's accessible to you. But also, as you do that, investigation of identity belief, see if that very investigation of it can help you step outside of that whole game, that whole system. So you can find something about investigation, something about awareness, about presence and mindfulness, that frees you from being caught in the middle of that game. And if you feel vulnerable or tentative as a result of that, great. We like that. So those are my thoughts for today. And it was really a delight for me to have the interviews today. I saw all of you. And I have so much respect and appreciation and inspiration from my sense of all of you coming and being on retreat here and your dedication to what you're doing here. And from my point of view, this is a very special retreat. I think there's a quality here that all of you bring, seriousness, devotion, stillness, maturity, that is a fairly high level. That if you know most other retreats that I go teach, there's a wide range of people there, people who are just checking it out for the first time, and here there's a, you know, we don't have any people checking out for the first time, unless you all are, and it was really genuinely quite very nice for me, and I already feel that even though it's the first day of the retreat, which is traditionally a very hard day for people, and I'm sure it's been hard for many of you. I feel that the kind of subtleness and a seriousness and a groundedness, which I would like to just encourage and encourage, kind of mirror. Part of why I'm talking about this now is to mirror it back to you, so that you will also take it more seriously and feel inspired by it and continue diligently with your efforts here. So, I thank you and. Please carry on.